Johnny Camerato, welcome.
Hi.
Now, you love to tell a good story, paint a picture with words. What drives this passion?
It sounds funny to say, but I've been doing this literally as long as I can remember. I mean, going way, way back to middle school, at least, and creative writing competitions way back then. Pretty much just like an inborn thing, like a painter wants to paint or something.
Was there a big light bulb moment for you?
You know, it's funny, the light bulb moment wasn't as exciting as somebody might think. It wasn't when I was on stage with this famous poet or that famous writer. Those moments came later, but the aha light bulb moment was at St. Francis College in Dr. Pichter's class, in a class called The Elements of Argument, and I'd written an essay about the license branch, of all things, real exciting. And he asked me to come up and read it to the class. And when the class was paying attention, and these are like maybe juniors in college, to a story about the license branch, and then I realized, if you can make this interesting, then you're on to something here.
So how did that revelation actually shape the writing that followed? It gravitated you toward that style?
Yes, it did, because the license branch essay that went over was what I would later come to learn creative nonfiction. I didn't have the technical vocabulary to call it that at the time, but that's what it was, and that was a branch that I took. The other branch being poetry, which is a different thing, though they can sometimes have the same themes.
That makes sense. And meanwhile, your writing is very, very interesting. You've proven that time and time again. So is your performing. And where did you get that passion for performing? Is that over and above the writing in your mind?
I don't think the performance is above it, but I think any solid piece should be equally entertaining to be heard as to be read.
It has to be a kick to see your stuff in print. What kind of a kick do you get performing it?
I love to perform these pieces, especially the creative nonfiction, because I feel like that format, it resonates with more people more of the time. I don't have delusions about the poetry. There's a rarefied audience for that, even among poets. Most of us are more interested in writing than we are hearing other people's stuff, whereas the creative nonfiction is democratic, especially in this day of the documentary and of Facebook stories.
Great point of both of those two things, but then you've just brought up written versus spoken word. Is there a difference in your mind and in your method, say, on the writing side of things while you're writing? Do you know what you're most envisioning this to be, written versus spoken?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I don't think of them ever as being mutually exclusive. There are elements of poetry in each essay, things like line rhyme and alliteration, that I intentionally use to give it a musicality of verse.
When it's spoken.
Yes.
That same thing does come out, at least on your printed page, and that is special, I think, to you and your work. But is that satisfying to you, the writer, then when you read it?
Yeah. In fact, sometimes I wonder if I'm not being a little, was that a cheeky alliteration? Was that a too much attention calling to it rhyme? I wonder about that stuff, but I'll try to make this short. One of my heroes that everybody knows is a hero of mine who knows me was Jim Carroll. And seeing Jim read chunks of his prose, and even though he was petrified in this wisp of a character on stage, typewritten pages shaking in his hand. It could have been the shakes from substance issues. It could have been fear or whatever. But once he started reading just these small excerpts from his books, his voice got stronger and stronger and stronger. And seeing that made me realize, hey, you know what? It can be poetic without being poetry. And a good avenue for us poets to get our work in front of people is to do these stories that are a little more accessible.
Great point.
Want a story.
And it works for you. Let's talk about your preferred platforms. You do slams and jams and live stage storytelling venues and Facebook. And you've even added musical backup and come to my own Meet the Music sound stage. Not necessarily conventional, Johnny.
Yeah, that's because the big guys won't have me.
But seriously.
And I don't know how to reach them. But yeah, you know, I'll be totally honest on this. Some people whom I'm not even particularly close to anymore dragged me kicking and screaming into the Facebook world to promote other projects. And they made a solid point. They're like, you're a writer. You're lucky enough to have some people care about the things you write. Get on this and help us promote what we're trying to do. And, you know, I'm glad they did. Because all of a sudden it opened up, hey, I might not be able to get out and read every week, but I can post one of these every week.
Oh, great. So, yeah.
And so it created a new format that seems to be reaching people that aren't necessarily coming to the poetry projects or the story project, but because they're at home in their living room and they seem to be enjoying it.
Just makes it more accessible and more fun for you, it seems like.
Yeah. You know, I don't have any children to post pictures of, and I don't really know how to take food pictures. So maybe every couple of weeks, sometimes a few months, I won't write just for the sake of writing on there. But I feel like when I put something out that matters to me, people seem to respond positively. I'm humbled and amazed at their responses a lot of times. Yeah, it's very gratifying.
And you are reaching a lot of people. Good for you and good for them, of course. What do you make of the present grand revival of storytelling? I know it's important to you on a personal level, but platforms like Trapdoor here in town, how important are they for the soul?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that. I can't say enough good things about the Trapdoor Project. The voice that it's given to people that never thought they would get up on stage to do anything, much less get up on stage and tell a personal story, has been amazing. What I love about it as a format is the improvisatory nature of it. You know, I mean, I'm sitting here in your studio with my entire story written down, and I can go back and reread it. I love that you can't, by their rules, you can't have notes. You got to get up there and it's got to be in your head. It's you and a mic. And that's pretty raw in a good way.
And your story too. Yes, that's it. Yeah. It's intense and it's a cleansing thing, I know. And it's also a communal thing.
Yeah. You know, and it's funny how you picture things in your mind. I'm fortunate, even before YouTube, I've had videos of my various writing heroes doing their thing. And so what I kind of try to do is, okay, well, what's the nature of tonight's gig? It's me and a microphone and a memorized story. Going to try to go into Henry Rollins mode. I'm not as good as Henry Rollins, obviously, but that's okay. The mark. I've got sheets of paper that are story-like, and I'm a little edgy. There's some Jim Carroll. Got a pure poetry. There's John Berryman. Again, not saying that I am these people's equivalent, but just I try to get that mental image, and if I've heard them read, I sometimes try to pick up some of their diction, too.
That's very interesting, you know? And also, I think a tip to anybody that's out there wanting to know kind of sort of how you do it, but how one does it.
Yeah.
So, good food, eating, and making it is another one of your passions, but by your own admission, you don't follow cooking shows. I don't think you even own a television, and yet your latest piece is a deeply moving work of creative nonfiction honoring the late, great Anthony Bourdain. Now, how did that come about?
Yeah, you're right. I don't have any one cooking show. Again, with YouTube, I don't live in a cave. I have seen clips of Bourdain. But as a writer, I came to Bourdain as a writer. Kitchen Confidential, I picked up right when it came out. It didn't change my life. What it did was it resonated. I mean, anybody that's ever washed a dish could relate to that. You didn't have to be a three-star Michelin chef. You could be a prep cook, a line cook, anything for that to resonate. So I knew him as a writer. I also, from working at Hyde Brothers, knew that he had a couple of books of crime fiction. So I knew that, hey, here's a guy that's a darn good cook by anybody's standard, but he really wants to be a writer. And of course, we could relate to that. So I knew him really through his writing, and then, I kept aware of him. And then honestly, he came back more in my attention. This sounds silly to say, but he started dating a woman that I very much have affection for, Asia Argento. And when that developed, I kind of became aware of him a little more. And then that led to now.
So this homage, Black Dogs in the City, truly reads very well in print, John, but it sounds even sweeter. So would you share it with us now?
Sure. A much better writer than me once wrote that there are four perfect days a year in Manhattan, and they're all in October. Most of the time when the humidity is soaring or the mercury is plunging, I tend to agree with them. But on this past Monday, I caught a day that proved them wrong. 70 degrees, no humidity, and a steady breeze. The whole city seemed glad to be there, and so was I. First stop, Little Italy, for fresh clams on the half shell, at the famous Umberto's Clam House. It's where crazy Joey Gallo had his last meal back in the 1970s. The only way to eat these guys is with lemon and Tabasco sauce. They were followed by the main course of octopus salad, done right, never chewy, marinated in shaved garlic, olive oil, and parsley. I realize that some of you may not share my love for seafood, so if you were here with me on this day, we'd walk around the block to Chinatown, and if you couldn't find something you liked there, then we'd stop being friends. Normally, after a meal like this on such a day, I would take Houston. It's pronounced House-ton, not like the city in Texas. over to the Bowery, and then head north and visit my old haunts. The Bowery Poetry Project, CBGB's, the St. Mark's Bookstore. Then I'd sit in Tompkins Square Park and get high and stare at the pigeons and the Joe Strummer mural. But the Poetry Project was closed. Y'all know CBGB's is long gone, and the great St. Mark's Bookstore is now history too. And I don't get high anymore, at least not that park kind of high. So I decided that rather than walk with the ghost of the Bowery, I'd get a little lost. Not the oh shoot, 1980s, never gonna see Coney Island again lost, but to take some side roads uptown lost. At least as lost as someone who considers Union Square uptown could get. So I veered west, down a very pleasant 28th Street, and I did have to admit there was something to be said for it. The buildings were beautiful, and a girl who looked like she'd just climbed down from the billboard was doing a photo shoot, and literally was stopping traffic, and all was right with the world. When I turned the corner onto Lower Park Avenue, it got quiet. Quiet in Manhattan is rarely good, especially on a day that was already reminding me of September. Then I realized I was on Park Avenue between 28th Street and 27th Street, and this is where Anthony Bourdain's flagship restaurant, La Hales, is, and I'm standing right in front of it, and the entire facade has been turned into one huge memorial. There is a crowd of at least 100 people there, placing roses, writing notes, and fixing them to the wall. The United Nations could not have gathered a more diverse group of people. There were the chefs and restaurant owners, of course, some of them famous in their own right. But there was also the Hispanic waiter on his way to a shift at another place who stopped to leave a message in his own language, a language they shared, the true tongue of the kitchen. And so many more. The mood was subdued but not somber. I stayed for a few minutes and left right before the documentary crew got there. I was now more determined than ever to get to Union Square. I needed to see the monuments to other great men. I needed tactile proof that our heroes are not forgotten. I heard the square before I saw it. Rasta bucket drummers whose primal beats somehow blend seamlessly with the folk banjoist who does a pretty decent Pete Seeger. Oblivious to it all are the backgammon hustlers who are so good they can only play each other. In this people's kingdom, I grabbed a bench in the shade and pondered the black dog. How could a man who had on the surface everything I'd ever wanted throw in the dish towel way too soon? But then I looked at the truth. Experience answered my own question. When the black dog is at your door, nothing matters. A good job, a popular club, a little money in the bank, who cares? Not you. Not when it's real, real. On the blackest of days, I used to unload the bullets from my guns and give them to a friend for safekeeping. I lost the friend, so I got rid of the guns. You look at the phone and try to remember all those people who said they loved you, who said give them a call if you ever need anything. But you don't believe they meant it, so you crawl into a bed or a bath or maybe some homemade noodles with Pomodoro sauce, and it gets you through, if you're lucky. What you can't do is allow the black dog to sick his loyal henchmen, addiction and relapse, on you. They are formidable enemies and are not to be trifled with. So how about this? If you need somebody, keep calling until someone picks up. And if someone is calling you, then please pick up. Then I put these thoughts away and had a better one. I thought of a form of heaven that would be the exact same Monday, except when I walked by La Hales, Anthony Bourdain would come out the front door with a dozen of his beloved oysters in one hand and another dozen of my cherished cherry stones in the other hand. And because it's heaven, they stay ice cold as we walk back to Union Square together, and we grab an open bench between the Rasta bucket men and the backgammon gurus. And as we begin to eat, he tells me I should stick to my writing and leave the food game alone. I'll say, hey man, we all gotta eat, but maybe you should stick to food and leave the writing alone. After all, every jerk has at least one good book in them. Just ask Kerouac. Then we laugh, and you'll trade me an oyster for a clam and try to convince me your briny beast is better, but I'm not buying. Then we'll toast, but because it's heaven, neither one of us is drinking, so we'll clink our shells together and listen a while longer to those drums as the sun goes long over the city we love.
Johnny Camerata was a Fort Wayne writer and multimedia artist. Thanks so much for joining us today, Johnny, and sharing this excerpt from this beautiful work, Black Dogs in the City. And here's to the memory of Anthony Bourdain.
Thanks a lot, Julia.